Step five says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And you'll notice in this preceding paragraph that I just read, three times he's mentioned that, but he didn't say wrongs. He said defects. You'll notice in step six that we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You'll notice in seven it says humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We'll notice as we go through this chapter that Bill used four words interchangeably back and forth. Wrongs, defects, shortcomings, and he also uses the term those things that are objectionable to us. And people used to ask Bill about this, and they'd say, Bill, why did you in step five use nature of the wrongs? Why did you in six use defects and seven use shortcomings? And Joe and I have had the opportunity to talk to two ladies, and both of them happened to be here last fall. One of them is a lady named Cora Louise, and one of them is a lady named Nell Wing. And they both worked with and for Bill for years. And they said invariably Bill would answer that question with this statement. Whenever I took English courses in college, they taught me never to use the same words in consecutive sentences to identify the same subject. He said, therefore, I call them different things in the steps, but said they are all the same identical thing. They are the things that we find in our inventory that block us off from God's will. And they're the things that we talk about to another human being. And they're the things we become willing to get rid of in six, and we ask him to take them away in seven, and he said you can call them anything you want to. That's why your fourth column on the inventory sheet says, what is the exact nature of my wrongs, faults, mistakes, defects, shortcomings, or whatever? Those are the things that really block us off. So what we're going to talk to this other human being about is the exact nature of our defects, our wrongs, our shortcomings, our personality traits, whatever you would like to call them. It really doesn't make any difference. And again, we'll refer to this later on and show you the interplay and the interchange and the use of these words. We think we've done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And that's just about as good a reason as I can think of. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to keep hiding stuff. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they've turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. Well, we think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now, I think here's where we had a disservice. When we see the word all and then followed up by our life story. And people couldn't figure out how to take the inventory, so they looked at that statement and they said, oh, that's the way you do it. You sit down and write all your life story. And for years and years around AA, everybody said that's the way you take the inventory. But you know, if you take it as the book says to take it, and you review your past and list your resentments, and review your past and list your fears, and review your past and list your harms, you will be sharing all your life story with another human being. Because you see, my resentments go back 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago, depending on how old we are. My fears, some of them stem from way, way back there. And most certainly, my wrongs do. You know, I wasn't too nice when I was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. I seemed to have a pattern in of hurting other people. Been doing that all my life. And if I really inventory it as the book says, I will be sharing all my life story. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. You know, you've got to be an actor to be a practicing alcoholic. You were a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde. On one hand, we want the world to look at us and see how great we are. And we strive and do our best to get the approval of other people. Yet on the other hand, we keep doing things which tears that approval down. And we're scared to death they're going to find out about it. The book says the inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As far as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of the day. He is under constant fear and tension. Now, and they're telling my story here. That's the story of my life. Hiding that stuff down inside me, keeping it hid. I don't want it to come to the surface. Don't want people to see it. Don't even want to look at it myself. Scared to death about it. And that makes for more drinking. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. Well, we spent thousands of dollars for examination. And we know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. It really doesn't make sense. Now, we'll go to a psychiatrist, and we'll pay him $50 or $75, $100 an hour, and lay down on his couch and sit there and tell him a bunch of damn lies. It's almost impossible for the practicing alcoholic to be honest with somebody else. And my book says, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we're to live long and happily in this world. Why would I think that all of a sudden, here I've been sober 30 days or 60 days or 90 days and I do step four, why would I think that I can suddenly be 100% honest with me? I've probably conned me during my lifetime more than I've conned other people. I could not have lived with what I was if I couldn't rationalize that stuff away and con me. And why would I think in step four I can be 100% honest? No way can I do that. I need another human being to help me see what my character defects really are. And the only way he can see it is to see the same thing that I've looked at, my inventory. And when he and I look at the inventory together, then he can guide me into the proper decisions regarding character defects. He can look at it from the outside. He's not involved, and he can be honest with it where I absolutely cannot.
Okay, page 74. Okay. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose a person whom we take this intimate and confidential step. And as Charlie said, the step says we're trying to find out the exact nature of our wrongs, and I doubt if we did that in step four. We did the best we could as we were involved in this. But the chances are, if we take an inventory to another, to the right person, and it's going to tell us exactly how to select this person, a person who is knowledgeable, that he is going to probably look at particularly the last four columns. He's going to look at the parts of self that was affected. And he's going to look at the exact nature of the wrongs. And by examining these columns over here, he is probably going to talk to us, and we're going to be able to move some of those check marks. You know, he can probably say, you know, I believe he's going to... Don't you think that this was caused by this rather than this? And actually, step five is going to be a refining or improving of the inventory to get more closely to the exact nature of the wrong. And that's why step five comes after four. You know, because step five is a positive step to improve our inventory. Now, throughout the book, and there's so much, so many things in the book. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, Charlie and I feel like, because we don't like to put our opinion, but it's the only book that we have that shows us how to work the steps. You know, the other books talk about it, but this is the only book that tells you exactly how to work the steps. And it's hard, you could have a problem within step five that I've never seen a problem that we didn't find. You can find your answer in the book. It tells you how to select this person. It tells you when to do it. It tells you when not to do it. It tells you how to do it. It gives you the results you should get. Everything is right in the book. If we study the big book, we can find all the information. And he tells us this unique person, how to select it. And I've never seen a person with a step, with any of these steps, that we couldn't find the answer in the book if we studied the big book. And I think, as we say all the time, usually in all these studies, one of the great difficulties with people taking the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think one of the greatest things we've been doing is they don't take the steps out of the book. You know, for some reason or other, many years ago, somebody saw fit to print the 12 steps, and that's good. And they have taken the 12 steps out of the big book, and we got them up on all of our club room walls. We got them on little cards, and that's fine. But a lot of people try to take the steps off of those little cards. And some of them try to take them off the wall. Now, the reason you can't take them off the wall, there is no instructions on the wall. There's no instructions on your little cards. The only place that you can find the instructions of taking the 12 steps is in the big book. And if you take them out of the big book with all their instructions, they're quite simple and quite easy. Now, he tells us how to select this person. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person in whom we are to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us who belong to religious domination, which requires confession, must, of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority and whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connections, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by religion, established religion. We often find such a person quickly to understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand. If we cannot, I would rather not do this. We search out an acquaintance, a close-mouthed, understanding friend. It says, perhaps our doctor, our psychologist will be the person. Now, we notice here when this is book is unchanged in 1939 when the big book was wrote, you know, this was really before sponsors, before the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous grew across the country, and we had sponsors. So he suggested here other people, but right today we know that this has changed, and we have plenty. The most knowledgeable person in this area probably is a recovered alcoholic who's available now. This was mentioned later in 12 and 12, but this was before the book hasn't been changed. And we know there are many recovered alcoholics, sponsors, who should be knowledgeable in this area of human nature. And we're very blessed to live in a time to have these people available with the insight. And the people, and those of us here have it to develop ourselves, to have the ability to help new people and to look into their, to take step five with. Now, you know, we can just imagine this book, and this is the way it was printed in 1939. If it was going to California and said, see a sponsor. Well, the guy didn't have no sponsor. There was no sponsor in California. So he said they suggested other people to do this. Now, it may be one of our family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which would hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we could tell to someone who will understand, yet be unaffected. In this case, you know, he said you could even do it at that time with some member of your family and then take the bad part you didn't want to tell them, tell it to somebody else. But he didn't make this available. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves but considerate of others. Notwithstanding the necessity of discussion ourselves with someone, it may be that one is so situated there is no suitable person available. Again, it's a timing. If that is so, This step may be postponed only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious to talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence and that he fully understand and approve of what we are driving at, and he not try to change our plans. But we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. Now he tells us how to take the step. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, again, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to a partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged on a life or death errand. Most people approach it this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it, eliminating every twist of character, every dark penny of the past. Now, then we get the results of step five after we take it. Once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us, and we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. And if we compare this, he says step three was just the beginning as we begin the recovery program. And, you know, step three is not an action step. It's just we just made a decision in the mind. But we find out there's more results after step five than it is after step three, because step three is an action step. You know, many people take step three and they're waiting for a spiritual experience. And if we study our book, he says the spiritual experience begins after step five, not step three. We start off believing it's step two, but at step five is the beginning of the spiritual experience. The real effect comes from after we really put some action into the program.
You remember back in the appendix that we read, it said we will know when we've had a spiritual experience when we become aware of the fact that we have tapped an unsuspected inner resource of strength. Well, the statement that Joe just read says we may have had certain spiritual beliefs. That's what we had in two. And belief was just suspicion. But it says now we begin to have a spiritual experience. By this stage of the game, we begin to know that something has taken place. We're no longer just believing. We're now getting some results, and we're beginning to know.
The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. Didn't say in every time. Sometime after step five, if you got a good, if he's right there, sometimes the feeling of the drink problem will disappear after step five. We'll feel we're on a broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Now, after we take step five, it's got a little rest. And you know, after you take these one, two, three, four, five, I think we deserve a rest. You know, and this is the only little rest in the steps. I love it. It says, it's like driving down the road, you know, you have a little park where you can stop for a while. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour.
Didn't say 38 days.
Yeah, he did, said an hour. I mean, he didn't have to. It must have been a point. He said 1 hour. Carefully viewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart we know him better. Now, it didn't say that we knew God. We didn't say we had a spiritual life. It just said we knew God better. So that means better than before we started step one. We know God better. Taking the book down from the shelves, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we read the first five steps. We ask, have we omitted anything for real building an arch to which we shall pass a free man at last? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement, put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And then again, we go back and we review the first five steps. And he's using the same parable he used before in step three. He says step three was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we passed to freedom. Remember, he said step two was the believing was the foundation stone. Step three was the keystone. We have put in a couple more stones. So he's really kind of paralleling to using the same picture. In step five, we'll put in a few more stones. Let's check those five stones and see if they are properly in place. And he says, if we can answer satisfactorily, if they are properly in place, if our work is good, then we move on to step six. What do you think? Looking at the time of birth.
Quarter. We're having a little consultation. Excuse us. I think one of the things I realized in the book up to this point is I don't have to wait till I get through with step nine to begin to receive some promises. We're beginning to see as we progress through each of these steps, we're beginning to receive certain things. Certain things are disappearing. Certain things are beginning to take place. I'm beginning to feel the nearness of the Creator. My attitude is beginning to change. And things are looking better all the way around. So, I think what's happened to so many of us in the past is we haven't realized the results we can actually get as we go through the steps one by one by one. And it's extremely important that we discuss this thing with this other human beings so they can help us figure out just exactly what it is we're trying to do. Now we know that confession is good for the soul. Just a simple confession is good to let other person or another human being share some of this stuff with us. But I keep hearing that story about the guy that did his fifth step with the fellow that spoke only Spanish. And then he took him out in a boat and he drowned him after it was over. I'm sure he got some relief from the confession. But I doubt if he found out a hell of a lot about himself as to what makes him tick and what he needs to change, etc. So probably in the discussion with the other human being, we're going to have a lot more stuff revealed to us. And what we're really dealing with is the exact nature of these defects or the exact nature of the wrong. And again, I had a word there that confused me. One day I went to the dictionary and looked up the word nature. And nature says the inherent, or that word is defined as the inherent characteristic of something. And as I go to this fellow and discuss my wrongs, the resentment is a wrong. You know, that's wrong judging, and that cuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. As I go to him and discuss my fears, the fear is the wrong. That cuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. As I go to him and discuss my wrongs, the things I did, they cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. But what I'm really interested in is what's the nature of those things? What's the inherent characteristic? What is it that allows those to surface? And that's where we look at that selfishness and self-seeking and dishonesty and inconsiderate. See, I can steal money from you. And I can use that money for a lot of different purposes. I might steal your money to buy a car so I can impress other people with how great I am and use that to build my self-esteem. Or I can steal money from you to buy a car to impress a good-looking girl so I can take her out on a date and go to bed with her. What is the nature of the wrong? The damn stealing of the money is the wrong, but what's the nature of it? And when I really get to look at those things, for the first time in my life, I begin to see what makes me tick. And I find that most of my problems don't deal with material security. Most of them don't deal with the sexual instinct. Most of them deal with what other people are going to think. I find that I've become a liar and a con artist and a cheat and a manipulator trying to impress other people to get them to approve me so I can feel better myself. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that's afraid of starving to death. But I've seen a hell of a lot of us that was afraid we wouldn't have enough money to impress other people with how great we are. And when I really begin to examine that stuff, I find out I'm really not such a bad person after all. I'm just a frightened human being trying to get other people to like me, trying to make myself feel better, and I do most of those things for that particular reason. The fourth and fifth step for me was one of the most revealing things that ever happened to me in my lifetime. From that, I could begin to see what I've really got to change in my personality if I want to live with any peace of mind whatsoever.
Okay.
I might, we're going to stop the big book study right here. We're running a little ahead of time. We're going to give you a little unexpected break. I've had a request that I tell you about my dog.
Oh, no.
Since we've been talking about sex, everybody who has a dog calls him Rover, but I call my dog Sex. Now, Sex has been very embarrassing to me. When I went to City Hall to renew his license, I told the clerk I would like to have a license for Sex. And he said, I'd like to have one too. And then I said, but you don't understand, this is a dog. And he said, well, I don't care what she looks like. And then I said, but you don't understand, I've had sex since I was 9 years old. And he said, man, you must have been quite a kid. When I got married, my wife and I went on our honeymoon, and we took the dog with us. And I told the motel clerk that I wanted a room for my wife and me and a special room for Sex. He said, every room in the place is for Sex. And I said, but you don't understand, Sex keeps me awake at night. And he said, me too. When my wife and I separated, we went to court to fight for custody of the dog. And I said, Your Honor, I had sex before I was married. And the judge said, me too. And then I told him that after I was married, Sex left me, and he said, me too. Last night, Sex ran off again, and I spent hours looking around town for him, and a policeman came over to me in the back alley at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, what are you doing out here? And I said, I'm looking for Sex. My case comes up in court next week. Thank you all for being with us this morning. We'll see you this evening, okay?
Real alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
Through God's grace and because this program works in my life, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since March the 10th of 1962. Good to be back for our big book study tonight. We're going to move on through these recovery steps. We begin, and we'll go back to our recovery program. We begin in the recovery step, step three, which is the first step in recovery. And as we said, the whole process was all about turning our will and our lives to the care of God. Changing of directions is what this program is all about. And we begin in step three when we made a decision to turn our will and our lives with the care of God, and this was the first step in recovery. In order to carry out that decision, and it was a lot of work that had to be done. And we talked about that we are a product of the stock in trade. We are a product of our minds. That's the sum total of each and every one of our lives is what we think. And, you know, we said that our minds are 100% full. And we wake up in the morning, whether that thing just comes on, it's 100% full. And the only way that God can come out into our lives, we have to go to work to remove some things to make room so that God can come out into our lives. So we begin the inventory of taking value of the stock in trade, seeing the things that's necessary that we want to get rid of. And we begin the process. In step four, we went through the three manifestations of self. We did an inventory of our resentments, and then we went through an inventory of our fears, and we made an inventory of our sex conduct and our conflict with other people. Just thinking about back as we went over that, you know, when we put down the harms done to other people on our sex conduct list, just before we finish that list, we should also add on that same list harms that cause others by anything else we have done in our lives, not just our sex conduct. Now, later on our book, when we get to steps 8, says that we should have completed this list in step 4. So this third sheet will be the list that we'll have ready for step 8 if we complete it as we do the inventory. And once these three things are completed, then we went into step five, where we relate these things to God and to ourselves as another human being. And we said that through each of these steps we would get some psychic change, or the psychic change would occur gradually as a result of step four. We would learn tolerance, peace, and goodwill toward all men. And in step five, we would find the nearness of our Creator. And we had certain spiritual beliefs, but this would be the beginning of the spiritual experience. So this brings us to step six and seven after we would do our review. And after we review these first five proposals, this brings us to the top of page 76, which, when if we can answer satisfaction to that, it brings us to step six and seven.
My name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and with the grace and the power I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since October 29th, 1969, one day at a time. And for this, I'm very grateful. I have to remind myself of that every once in a while.
You switched on me.
At the top of page 76, it says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. And of course, answering to our satisfaction would be where we had carefully read the first five proposals and asked if we had omitted anything, or if we'd tried to make cement without skimped on the cement put into the foundation, or tried to make mortar without sand. And if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. When ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that You should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that You now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to You and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do Your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step seven. And we kind of like to refer to step six and seven as bang-bang steps, because it really doesn't take very long to take them after we have become ready to do them. And if we would notice again in the wording in these two paragraphs I just read, we see the interchangeability of the words that we referred to in step five. In step five, it says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But the information we read in step five said the exact nature or the exact defects of character. And we said that right later on we would see this same thing where He used different words to identify these same terms. And we know that in step six it says we're entirely willing or ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Yet this first paragraph doesn't say that. It says, are we now ready to let Him remove the things which we have admitted are objectionable? And we know that step seven says humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Yet the second paragraph doesn't say that. It says, I pray that You now remove from me every single defect of character. So He used words out of 5, 6, and 7 interchangeably all the way through this part of the book. And I think the key to the whole thing is the things that we have admitted are objectionable. In other words, when we took step 4, we found some damaged and unsaleable goods on our shelf. We inventoried our mind. And we could see where those damaged and unsaleable goods would block us off from God's will. And when we saw that, then they began to become objectionable to us. We began to see that they needed to be removed. In looking at the resentments and the fears and the wrongs, we could see our basic personality traits or defects or whatever you want to call them that created that. We could see the selfishness and the self-seeking and the being frightened and the inconsiderate and the dishonesty that caused us to have those wrongs or the resentments and the fears and the harms we do to others. And we can begin to see if we don't get that out of our personality, we'll never be able to change. And if we don't change, then God can't enter the mind. So they begin to become objectionable to us as far back as step four. In step five, when we talk about them to another human being. And they help us isolate these things and determine what they are. And they become more objectionable to us. And by the time we reach step six, we're beginning to be willing to turn loose of those character defects or those shortcomings or those things we've admitted are objectionable, because we can see where they really are the things that's creating the problem. That old being selfish, and that old being frightened, and that old being dishonest, and that old being inconsiderate of other people. And the book recognizes in every step from three on that self cannot overcome self. It suggests to me in this step six paragraph that if I'm not willing to have those things removed, then I need to ask for the willingness until the willingness comes. And I think we need to recognize that some of our character defects, even though we may see where they're creating problems for us, sometimes we don't want to turn loose of them because they are enjoyable to a certain extent. You know, my selfishness, I can just do all kinds of things with that I enjoy. My dishonesty, hell, I've lived that way all my life. And it's difficult to become an honest person. Everybody likes to lie just a little bit, you know. My being frightened gives me excuses for not doing things that I really need to be done, but I can procrastinate and put them off if I can stay frightened long enough. My inconsideration of other people allows me to rationalize doing things I would like to do that I know I really shouldn't do. And I think we need to recognize that even though we can see character defects are beginning to hurt us, and we need to get rid of them if we want to receive God's will, sometimes it's a very difficult thing to do because they have become such a part and such a pattern of our life. And the book recognizes this when it says if we're not willing, we will need to pray and ask for the willingness to be willing to get rid of these things. Then when we are ready to get rid of them, we simply ask God to remove them and take them away. And it really doesn't make any difference what we call them. Now, what difference does it make whether I call it a defect or a shortcoming or a mistake or a fault or an objectionable thing? It's what I see that needs to go out of my character in order for me to change. And when I'm ready, I ask God to remove them. And I think probably a great mistake that we make in AA is that we feel that when we ask God to remove them, He'll just reach in and pluck them out and poof, they'll be gone, just like that. Nature will not allow a vacuum. Nature will not allow a void. Everywhere, as far as we know in this universe, whether there's a vacuum or a void, there's something rushing in to fill it up, whether it's in the material world or what. And we don't think that nature will allow a void in the human personality. I don't think God would reach in and pluck out a character defect from me and leave a hole in my personality. Hell, if He reached in and plucked out all my character defects and left a hole for each one, I wouldn't have any personality left. And it's impossible for me to function without some kind of personality. The mind's going to be filled with something. And if He takes away the selfishness, then something has to enter in to replace that. If He takes away the fear, then something has to enter in to replace that. If He takes away the dishonesty, then something has to replace that. If He takes away the inconsideration, then something has to replace that. Now, He does give me the ability to think and reason. And I believe that if I could look to see what the opposite of selfishness is, which would, of course, be interested in other people more so than in myself. And if I ask Him to take away selfishness, then if I could begin to try to practice unselfishness, being interested in other people, then maybe something could begin to come in to fill in the void that would be left when selfishness goes away. Perhaps if I would ask Him to take away dishonesty, maybe I ought to start trying to be honest and tell the truth and live an honest kind of life. And perhaps there would not be a void left in my personality. Maybe if I want Him to take away my fear, then I should start trying to practice courage and do the things that I've always been afraid to do, and the things I've procrastinated on because of fear of failure. Maybe if I want him to take away my inconsideration, I need to start trying to be more considerate of other human beings. You know, we don't think God's going to do for us the things we can do ourselves. And we can force ourselves to practice and try to be the opposite of the character defect that we're asking him to take away. You know, it's kind of like growing corn. You know, if I go out here and plant corn, I make the furrow in the ground, and I put the corn in the ground, and I put the fertilizer with it, and then I cover it up with dirt. And then I have to walk away and leave it alone. And God makes the corn grow. I can't do that. But at the same time God makes the corn grow, he makes weeds grow in my corn patch. And if I really want my corn to be top-notch, high-quality corn, then I need to get in there with God and pull the weeds out of the corn patch. You know, I've never seen God in a corn patch yet pulling weeds. I'm going to have to do my part to have top-notch corn. Now, if I want to change my personality and have a top-notch personality, the best that I can, and I am after the best, you know, I'll never be perfect, but it's certainly okay to aim toward perfection. And if I want to be the best I can, then I need to do my part. And as God removes and Charlie tries, gradually my personality can begin to change. You see, what I really am, I'm a set of mental habits. And my mental habits have been developed over my entire lifetime by the things that were taught to me, by the things that's happened to me, by the things I've done, by reactions, and etc. And when you say or do something to me, I automatically tend to react habitually. Now, with God's help, I can change my mental habits. And the only thing I'm going to do in this particular area is start changing from a set of old habits which continually keep me in hot water, continually keep me restless and irritable and discontented, continually keep me full of shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, and start changing from that set of habits to a new set of habits in my thinking. And if my thinking process can change, then most certainly my actions will change. And if they change, then most certainly my life will start becoming better. But if I continue to try to think the way I've always thought, and if I continue to try to run the show on my mind, then I continue to do the same things I've always done. And I will continue to get the same things that I've always got, which turned out to be a living hell for me. So again, it's not a question of whether I want to do this or not. The question is, how long can I live without doing this? Now, for normal people, they can run around 75% sick probably the rest of their life. And they can go home and have a drink or two in the evening, and it doesn't bother them. But if I run around sick in my head, my book tells me that after a while, insanity returns. And I drink again, and to drink is to die. And I think our book recognizes that this is a very difficult, hard procedure. And certainly it does never tell us that we're going to want to do this. But it becomes a matter of survival. We can either do this or perhaps go back to what we used to be. And I can't afford to go back there anymore. I just can't be there anymore, Joe.
Yeah, this is a very difficult thing. And at this point, we can easily see why we are capable of even performing it. Having preserved through the first early five steps and completed those steps, we're now in a position for change. Before in our lives, I think none of us have always tried to change our lives. You know, I always tried to change my life. I never did really like my life. But I didn't know how to change it. And they tell me now I can change my thinking. These earlier steps have made it possible for me to change my thinking. And once I change my thinking, my action will change automatically. My life will change. So we enter this plane, and it's through this work, it gives us the opportunity to change. And the one way you can really change, as Charlie was bringing the point out, the only way you can change is work against yourself. You can never change doing what you want to do. Because if you continue doing what you want to do, you will be the same person. You change by doing what you don't want to do. You know, this is the same way, you know, with our physical beings. You know, I was watching a lot of people around today doing some of those things, and they were out walking and exercising, and they had a frown on their face, you know. And when a person is jogging, he ain't having fun. See, he's doing something. He's working against himself because he'd rather be laying up on the couch. Now, that's the way I do in that area. You can see I'm sure there's a better human being inside of this glob that's sitting here. Down inside of this body, there's a better human being, and I can get him out if I do what I don't want to do. But I have a bad habit of doing what I want to do in that situation. And I always tell him, Lou Bell bought me a beautiful velour jogging suit. And I put it on, and I haven't lost a bit of weight. I like to put it on in the wintertime and get up on the couch and watch the football game and eat jelly beans, you know. But the way that I would find this better physical person would do the things I don't want to do or work against myself, and a better person would come out. Well, the same way in our mind. You know, our mind is going to still feed us the old thought patterns. And we're going to have to use the theme on the little slogans, think, easy does it. Take yourself off the automatic response. Because the chances are your automatic response is going to be wrong. And if you will be able to use those things to slow your life down and pause, then if you not do your automatic response and force yourself the other way, then these things will begin. We quit feeding these old thought patterns in our minds. And as our minds, if we have the right, we actually have to make a decision to lend actions to each thought our mind produces. And we alcoholics, our minds has got us living off of garbage. It's got better stuff. But if we would deny ourselves and deny the early impulses that we have, then our mind would reach back and give us better things. So now we're in a plane of change, and we do change by, our book says, what the old ideas are suddenly cast aside, because once we begin to feed them, we get some new ones. And a new set of motives begin to dominate our lives. And it says we can have a complete revolutionary change, a complete turnaround in our reactions to life. And all comes through step 6 and 7 as we practice these in our lives. You know, stop. And I, when I first come to the program and I share this, I hope it's a lot of new people struggling with this thing. I didn't really know. I had God's, just having had a conscious contact with God, you know, God's directions weren't plain in my life. And I didn't had a lot of problems with sick. I didn't know which was the right way, what not to do. But if we slow ourselves down, and because we're trying to learn a new lifestyle, anything you're trying to do new, you need to slow it down. And I would, when something would occur in my life, I used to always say, well, which is the right course to take? And I didn't know what was right. And I didn't know what was wrong, but I had a little question I would always ask myself to determine which course to take. I would always say to myself, Joe, what do you want to do? And when I found out what I wanted to do, I would do just the opposite. And I come out right most of the time. Because, you know, I was just always wrong. Do not do what you want to do. Work against what you want to do. You know, this is the way we make the changes in step 6. Is not giving into the old ideas, but practicing the new. And finally, these new actions will become a part of our lives. And we find out we have made a revolutionary change, and we begin to do the things we don't want to do.
In fact, we heard a story not long ago about the mind that would be appropriate to fit in here. And the story was about a brain surgeon who had developed a way to transplant the brain. Where if people wanted an entirely new brain, he could do this job for them. And this one fellow, he was tired of his, so he went to the brain surgeon and he asked him, about the brain transplant procedure. And the surgeon said, oh, yeah, I can do that, no problem. He said, I've got it perfected now, and we're 100% perfect on it, no problem at all. And the guy said, well, what do you have? And he said, well, I've got some over here in a display case. If you'd look at them, I'll show you. And he took him over there, and he said, now, here's a brain here that belonged to a lawyer. And he said, I'd be happy to transplant this brain in your head for $10,000. And the guy said, well, that's fine. He said, have you got anything else? And he said, well, certainly. He said, over here, I've got a brain that belonged to a doctor. And he said, I'd be happy to transplant this brain in your head for $50,000. And the fellow said, well, do you have anything else? And he said, sure, over here in this other case, I've got a brain that belonged to an alcoholic. And he said, I'd be happy to transplant this brain in your head for $100,000. And the guy said, I don't understand. He said, why do you want 10 for the lawyer, 50 for the doctor, and 100 for the alcoholic? And he said, well, hell, man, it's brand new. It ain't never been used yet.
It really has. You know, our book talks about this thing. You know, we have never used our minds. Our book says our thought life will be on a higher plane. And all our lives, you know, our minds have been feeding us off of garbage and reactions and our emotions. And now once this is cleared out, then we're going to be placed on a higher plane in our thought life. You know what I mean? And this is going to go on for the rest of the life as we refine these things in our minds.
Okay, gradually this process takes place, and we begin to change, and we begin to change. Again, we find our mental attitudes are changing a little. A little more of that old restlessness and irritability and discontent goes. A little more of the shame, fear, guilt, and remorse is gone because we're not doing some of the things we used to do. And we're getting a little happiness, a little peace of mind, and a little serenity. And for the first time in our life, through these first 7 steps, we're probably right in 2 dimensions of life. We got right with God in 1, 2, and 3 when we decided to let God be the director of our life. Let Him be the father, and we'll be the child, and He'll run the show, and we won't. And we set up the proper relationship with the Spirit. So we're right in the first dimension of life. We begin to get right with ourselves in this 4, 5, 6, and 7. We begin to see what makes us tick, why we do the things we do, and the problems that creates for us. And we begin to see how to get rid of it and keep it from coming back. And our minds do begin to clear up. And we begin to be able to use this great gift that God has given to us. Because a whole bunch of this garbage now is gone. The unsalable items have been removed. Now the good items that were there originally is left on the shelf, but new good items can come in and fill that shelf up now. And we're right in the second dimension of life. And as we said earlier, man is a tri-dimensional creature. And if we really want to be happy, we have to be right in all 3 dimensions. A proper balance. And we know that the 3rd dimension is our physical or social or sociological world, or our relationship with our bodies and with everybody and everything else in the world. And God knows nobody's 3rd dimension could possibly get any sicker than we alcoholics. Now, we've just fouled up so many, many good relationships in the past. And if we really want to live in this 3rd dimension properly, then we will need to do something about straightening up our relationship with the world and the people in it. And again, not necessarily because we want to all the time, but simply because we almost have to. If I want peace of mind, I've got to get rid of guilt. It'll gnaw on me from now on if I don't. If I want peace of mind, I've got to get rid of remorse. If I want peace of mind, I've got to get rid of fear. And if I've done things to people and they don't know about it yet, then I've got to be afraid of what are they going to say and what are they going to think and what are they going to do when they do find out about it. And I just can't seem to run around with this stuff in my head because, again, I'm blocked off from the sunlight of the Spirit. and my peace of mind is shot. And insanity returns, and sooner or later I drink. And to drink is to die. So my book, in its great wisdom, and in the pattern that the steps are laid out in, now gives me two more steps that will get me right in the third dimension of life. And that's with the world and the people in it, and they're steps 8 and 9, of course. And we can see in our three circles over here that we've kind of broken the steps up into those three areas. 1, 2, and 3 in the first dimension, and 4, 5, 6, and 7 in the second, and 8 and 9 in the third dimension. And the book says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we've harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. And that's why Joe made the suggestion a while ago, when we've reviewed our sexual conduct in the years past in the inventory and listed the people we've hurt, well, we might as well go ahead and list all the others we've hurt also. If we don't do it in 4, we will need to do it by the time we get to 8. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we can go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Prayer in every step. It recognizes that self can't overcome self. And we're really not too swift about doing this thing it's getting ready to tell us to do, you know. And it recognizes that we won't want to do this, and said if we haven't the will to do it, we ask until it comes. We'll have to get the power from a source greater than us to be willing to make these amends. You know, they don't really come too easily for alcoholics. And I know in this area of the book, again, I had extreme difficulty. Because I would look at step 8, and it said we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I looked at that thing, and I said, man, I'll never be able to do this step 8. Because there are some people that I've harmed that I really don't want to make amends to them, and I'm not willing to make amends to them, and I'll never be willing to make amends to them because they did things to me that was just as bad or worse than anything I ever did to them. And I said, I can't take step 8. And I know I went to my sponsor and I talked to him about that, and I told him this same thing. And he said, well, Charlie, he said, probably you're really looking at step 9. He said, step 8 doesn't say anything about making amends. He says, step 9 talks about making amends. So step 8 talks about being willing to make amends. He said, why don't you quit looking at 9 and look at 8 only? And I said, okay. And I did, and I read it to him. I said, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to. And I said, I'm not willing to make amends to. So I can't do step 8. He said, well, tell you what let's do. He said, let's treat step 8 as a 2-part step. He said, many of our steps have 2 or 3 parts in them, and step 8 does have 2 parts. He said, look, let's look at the first half of step 8. He said, what does it say? And I said, it says, made a list of all persons we had harmed. He said, do you know all the people you've harmed? And I said, yeah. He said, well, then make the damn list. He said, you can do that, can you not? And I said, yeah, I believe I could probably do that. Don't want to, but yeah. He said, okay, go make it. And said, when you get it made, bring it to me and we'll talk about it. So I wandered off and I finished up the list that I'd already started in step 4. And some day, 2, 3, 4 later, I don't know, I took it back to him and I said, here's the damn list. I said, but I'm not going to make amends to some of the people on that list. And he said, I know that. He said, I know you better than anybody in the world knows you. But he said, I also know there's some people on that list that you love. He said, after all, you took your 5th step with me, and I know about a lot of this stuff about you. And he said, I know there's some people on that list you love, and they love you, and you would like to get your life straightened out with them right now. Isn't that true? And I said, yeah. My mother, my wife, my children, my brother. He said, okay, let's take a piece of paper and let's divide it into four columns. And he said, let's take the left-hand column and at the top of the column, let's put right now. And he said, extract those names off of that list that you're ready to make amends to right now and put them under the right now column. Can you do that? I said, yeah. He said, okay, now there's some people on that list that you aren't too sure about. You're probably going to, but you're going to put it off about as long as you can. But he said, you know, sooner or later you're going to get around to making amends to them, right? I said, yeah. He said, okay, label the second column later and put their names under the second column. Can you do that? And I said, yeah. He said, all right, now there's some people on there that you really aren't sure about. You think you won't, but you're not sure that you won't. There is a possibility that you may want to do it sooner or later. He said, why don't you label the third column, maybe, and put their name under the third column. Can you do that? I said, yeah. He said, now let's take the fourth column. He said, there's some of them on your list that you're not ever going to make any amends to. You know it, I know it, and everybody else knows it, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, call the fourth column never and put their name under the fourth column. And I did that, and then he said, now start with the right now. And he said, probably by the time you're through with the right nows, you'll be ready for some laters. And when you're through with the laters, he said, you may be through ready for some maybes. And he said, I'd almost bet by the time you're through the maybes, you'll be willing to do a couple of those nevers. And you know, the old fool was right. He never guided me wrong. What he did for me was give me a place to become willing to make amends. You see, I had blocked 8 and 9 out of my life entirely. I'd blocked it out of my mind entirely. I could not do 8 and 9 because of one or two people. And he gave me a way to start the process where I could become willing as the process was accomplished. And finally, I became willing to make amends to them all. And it really did work for me. I don't know whether it would for you or not, but it certainly did for me. Joe?
Okay, as we go through this step, you're probably there are still some misgivings as we look over this of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel different from going to them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature of our approach. We might prejudice them. At this moment, we're trying to put our lives in order, but this is not the end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves into maximum service to God and to people about us. And I think, you know, this is, you know, we can actually see, you know, again, in the design of living, that we as people, that this is really what the purpose of life. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves into maximum service to God, which is inside of our lives, and to other people, which is on the outside of our lives. And as Charlie says, these steps are precise and specific, and they're very clear-cut. There's a lot of material in our book on steps 8 and 9. Steps 8 and 9 are given a lot of print. There's a lot of things that problems will come up in making these amends. And I guess this is why our book was so much detail about it. It talks about money, it talks about criminal offenses, it talks about divorces, it talks about our past sexual problems. There's not a problem, again, there's not a problem that on steps 8 and 9 that is not dealt with within the pages of the big book. If we would study our big book and it tells us how to do these two steps. Just as Charlie talks about the two points in step 8 and 9, the steps 8, we can look at the different changes, it's not a one-process thing. And the different processes that lie within step 9. And he tells us to make direct amends. That's one thing he tells us to do. And that would be to the total list. And that's pretty tough. But then we look at the next statement. He says, wherever possible. So that takes some of the people off the list. And then it says, when to do so would injure others. That takes some of the other people off of the list. So it's really not, if once we get into to see the processes, this is for a person to begin with, and it's something that's not impossible once we understand it. You know, Charlie and I always would talk about the steps, and so over the years ago, it's changed a lot now because, you know, we get things from General Service and from our central offices. But back in the some years ago, it was a custom around most of the groups to have one of the local printers, one of the members would print a 12-step board. And they would, or else you might hear somebody reading the steps at meetings. And we looked up, we would always go in the club rooms, and we'd love to examine the 12-step boards. And we'd be surprised, we'd always find that as they copied the steps out of the book and put them on the boards, they would change them. Instead of, a lot of times in step nine, instead of saying, make amends, it would say, make direct amends wherever possible. And on most all the boards, it would say, make direct amends whenever possible. Now, can you imagine a drunk making amends whenever he wanted to? And it says wherever. And this is all the steps are spiritual after step three. We're not doing it by ourselves. Wherever this becomes possible, and this would be God, this is when we are to make that amend. When God sets it up, wherever possible, this is when we make that amend. Not on our own timing, because we don't know what's going on in life. We might know what's going on in our lives, but we don't know what's going on in the life of the person we are to make this amend. So it's wherever possible. But he does tell us when not to. When to do so would injure these or others. And if these steps are worked, if we once we understand them in depth, we'll see that it's not an impossible task once we fully understand the process. It's a process that probably that maybe we can never complete. There are things people will be on this list which bring about injury, so they remain there. There may be wherever possible they remain there. But the key thing in making amends is the second part of step eight, which is with the willingness. The freedom comes through the willingness, not through step nine, but through the willingness if we can. This is the freedom that we want. Now, just as we look at these circles too, just in passing, and we see the real benefit of steps eight and nine. Now, if we don't go out and do this, and this is why he tells us that if we've come this far and we don't work on this step, if we don't clear up our relationships with other people, then we're going to have guilt and fear and a backup in our minds. We're going to have problems in 4, 5, 6, and 7 if we don't go out and continue working the program. Now, if we get problems back in our minds, it's going to cut us off from the Spirit, which is in the center, and we're going to drink again. You know, we say we're trying to get well from the inside out, and we can get sick from the outside coming back in.
And I think also when he says direct amends, he says we made direct amends to such people wherever possible. There's probably two meanings of the word direct. One, I would think, would be that we go to these people directly on a face-to-face basis. The book tells me it's okay to make a phone call if I have to, or to write a letter, but better to meet them directly on a face-to-face basis. It seems as though there's more relief comes from this. If we make a direct face-to-face amend to this person that we owe the amend to. In many cases, it gives that person an opportunity to make an amend perhaps for what they have done. And then an old, long-standing feud can melt away and we become friends again. But I think another meaning of the word direct also is equal restitution. For instance, if I stole $400 from you when I'm drinking, And I walk up to you now that I'm in AA and I'm making my amends, and I say, "Say, Jack, I'm sorry. Back in such and such a date and such a time, I stole $400 from you, and I'm sure sorry about that. Would you forgive me?" Well, chances are you're going to say, "I'm pretty damn sorry about it too. Where's my $400? What we are after is to get relief from guilt and remorse. Hopefully they're going to like us. Hopefully they're going to accept us. But in order for me to get full, complete relief from the guilt associated with this, I would need, if at all possible, to pay you back your $400. And then it can be free and clear from my mind." And we realize there's probably some cases where we can never do this. But wherever possible, we should. We need to extract as much relief out of this as we possibly can. And the book tells me to do this with all of these people, except when to do so would injure them, or just as importantly, when it would injure other people. And I think this is an area we need to be very, very careful at. Sometimes in our zeal to do the steps 100% perfect, sometimes in our zeal to remove guilt and remorse, we tend to jump into amends without considering the effect it'll have on other people. And sometimes we hurt the person that we owe the amend to, even worse yet. And if we do, then we get to carry that guilt around with us too. And sometimes, even though it doesn't hurt the person we owe the amend to, it will hurt some other people. And if it does, then we can carry that guilt around with us too. So we have in the book two or three good examples, and we'd like to look at a couple of the short ones to see what they're talking about when they're talking about harming those people, or just as importantly, others. In the middle of page 78, it says, "Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we're trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory that it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors, no matter how far we have to go. For we're liable to drink if we're afraid to face them." This is the direct amends thing. Make an equal restitution wherever we possibly can. "Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good." I can't imagine any alcoholic doing that. "We've already admitted this in confidence to another person. We did that in step 5. But we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number 1. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. There is prayer in every step." Now, this step recognizes this isn't going to be easy, and we're going to have to ask for the power. "We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Now, an example. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife, and she was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, 'Here I am.' Now, we thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, But if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not, and the whole situation has long since been adjusted. And here the man had to consider the other family, the new family that he was now married into in the starting of a new life. And after careful consideration, then he decided how to go about making the amends. We must be very careful about it. Page 80. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. Now, he felt he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? After consulting with his wife and partner, those that would be affected, after consulting with them, he came to the conclusion it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he's one of the most trusted citizens of this town. This all happened years ago. Carefully considering other people and what effect this would have on them. One more. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we're mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. I can't imagine alcoholics doing it. We doubt if in this respect alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife, or we probably could say a husband, gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely and sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he's having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand. But what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he's married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure that our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we've been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She'll want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We're sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it should not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we've often found this the best course to take. Being suspicious doesn't seem to be quite as bad as having full, complete knowledge. And I really believe my wife is better off being suspicious than she would be knowing the blow-by-blow details and who it was and where it was and when it was and how it was. I think this is an area where we have to be very careful. And we see people do this in their rush to relieve themselves of the guilt. They go in and they begin to tell things that perhaps they really shouldn't be talking about at all. Now, I know if the shoe was on the other foot, I damn sight my wife left me suspicious than to leave me with full detail of all the knowledge. If they generally know, and they generally do, if we've been doing that, I don't really know that it's necessary to go that much further with this thing. Because if we do, we're going to end up hurting that person further. And just as importantly, if your wife is like mine, and she's a red-headed Indian gal, she ends up hurting some other damn people too. And then I get to feel guilty about the whole mess all over again.
Okay, perhaps there on page 82 are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can praise such an intimate situation. It may be that both decided the way of good sense and loving kindness is let bygones be bygones. Each night, pray about it. Again, we have prayer. Having the other one's happiness utmost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we're dealing with the most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Okay, over on page, top of page 83. Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumming that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. You know, it's prayer throughout each and every one of these steps, because we can't, there's no way that we could work step 89. I think that's a great difficulty. That after we do step 3, we actually try to go into some do-it-yourself processes, not using the prayer that's constantly revealed throughout the steps.
Okay, the third paragraph on page 83, there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. And that's true. You know, some of the people we owe amends to, we simply cannot make them because it would harm them further or perhaps harm somebody else. Some of the people we owe amends to might already be dead, and there's no way that we could go make an amend to them. And my book tells me we don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. If we are willing to make these amends wherever we can possibly make them without injuring other people, then we have fulfilled the intent of step 9, provided we've made those that we can. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't let delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And one of the greatest mistakes that we see being made in step 9 is in our need to have people like us. When we go out and we make these amends and we want them to accept the amends and accept us for what we are and love us, and sometimes they don't do that. And once in a while you run into one that said, I didn't like you too damn well when you did it and I still don't like you now. And if we aren't careful, we tend to want to go back and keep going back over and over and over, trying to make that amend, trying to get that person to like us, practically begging them to give us forgiveness. And my book says we don't need to do that. It says, as God's people, we stand on our own 2 feet. We don't have to crawl before anybody. The purpose of the making of the amend is to get rid of our guilt and our remorse. Now, if they like us, great. But that really isn't the purpose of doing it, is to get rid of guilt and remorse. And if they don't want to accept our amend, we still can get rid of our guilt and our remorse, whether they accept it or not. If they don't, that's really their problem. Probably the one we have amends to the most would be ourselves. I'm sure we've hurt ourselves as bad as we've ever hurt anybody else. And we tend to forgive those that hurt us. And they tend, and we expect them to forgive us for hurting them. But there's one person that we have a very difficult time in dealing with, and that's ourselves. We tend to forgive everybody but ourselves. And we keep beating ourselves on the head with that old stick of remorse and guilt over the things we've done in the past. Everybody else might have forgiven us, but we keep whacking ourselves in the head. We should have been better. We shouldn't have done that. So on, so on, so forth. That's nothing in the world but self-guilt. And self-guilt is nothing more than self-resentment. Resenting ourselves for what we have been and done in the past. Now, way back in step four, it told me how to get rid of resentments. It said you pray for the sucker that you resent. And I may have to ask God to give me the power and the willingness to forgive Charlie for what Charlie has been in the past. And if I can forgive me, then I've made the greatest amend to me that I can ever make to any human being. And if I don't forgive me, then I'll never have peace of mind. And I don't think we need to carry that load with us anymore. You know, when Bill went to Bob, and Bob went out and got drunk one more time, and Bob come back off of that drunk, and the next, when I went to the hospital parking lot, and Bill gave Bob the bottle of beer, and Bob drank it and went up and performed the proctology operation. I won't say that. He came out of that hospital and he didn't show back up where Bill was, and Bill just knew that bottle of beer had triggered the allergy, and Bob was off drunk. And it was hours later before he showed up. And Bill said, "Where in the hell have you been?" And he said, "I've been going down both sides of the street making amends." He had never been able to make them before. He had never been able to pursue the spiritual remedy to the extent that he needed to recover because of the shame associated with being an alcoholic and the things that he had done. And when Bill brought him the exact nature of his illness, he realized for the first time that he was really going to have to do this thing in depth. And that day he made his amends, and Dr. Bob never took another drink as long as he lived the rest of his life. So amends are damned important. I think we'll take a break, and then we will see the results we get from the first 9 steps of AA.
Good.
Okay, if everybody's ready to go, well, we'll fire it up so we can be done by 10:30. And again, looking at our chart that's up here on the screen, and we can see it by these first 9 steps, we now should be fairly well straightened out in all 3 dimensions. 1, 2, and 3 with God, and 4, 5, 6, and 7 with ourself, and 8 and 9 with other people. And again, for most of us, maybe for the first time in our life, and certainly in a long time, we are right in all 3 areas of our life. And if we're right in all 3 dimensions of life, then we should be peaceful. We should be happy. We should not be restless and irritable and discontented. And we should not be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Because we've done something about all of those things that were creating all the problems for us. And we think that's probably why on page 83 at the bottom of the page, we have a section that tells us how we're going to feel after step 9. And we always call it the promises. Now, of course, we've seen promises all the way through. But there's some more of them here on page 83 and 84. And my book says if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? Well, we think not. They are being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, spiritual experience, sometimes slowly, spiritual awakening. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I've heard in AA meeting after AA meeting that the only thing you have to do is keep coming to meetings, and sooner or later you'll soak her up by osmosis and you'll be all right. And that ain't what my book says. My book says I can have these things that it just described to me on one condition and one only, if we work for them. And if we have fully completed the first 9 steps to the best of our ability, then we can expect to feel the way this thing says. And if you look at those promises, they have nothing to do with the body at all. They all deal with the mind. Attitudes and outlook upon life, people, places, things in general. And if we have undergone those changes in our thought processes that this thing describes, then most certainly we have undergone a personality change. The way we think, and the way we feel, and the way we react to life. So we can really see that recovery is already being is brought about through this personality change through the first 9 steps. I want to read them one more time. I just love to read the promises. But this time I want to add some words to them of my own. And the words that I want to add are, whenever I used to take a drink of alcohol. Now this is back when alcohol was my friend. I found it when I was about 14. It made me 7 foot tall and made me good looking and straightened my eyes out and did everything that it could possibly do for me. When it was my buddy and did all the things I couldn't do for myself. This is the way alcohol used to make me feel before it became a problem in my life. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I did not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I comprehended the word serenity and I knew peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience would benefit others. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I lost interest in selfish things and gained interest in my fellows. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook on life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and of economic insecurity would leave me. When I took a drink of alcohol, I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. The amazing thing that I've discovered in my life, that all the good things that I got from alcohol when it was my friend, I now can get those same things and those same feelings from the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if I can get the same thing from the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I do not need to drink alcohol to change the way that I feel. And the amazing thing is, not only do I get the good from the first 9 steps, I get none of the bad that I used to get from alcohol. I've never been put in jail from working the first 9 steps. Never been filed for divorce over the first 9 steps. Never puked over the first 9 steps. Almost did a time or two, but not quite. So you see, I believe this would lead credence to the statement we already experienced in their recovery from the disease, because if I can get the same thing from the first nine steps, then I don't need to drink alcohol. I have no desire, no use to drink alcohol, because I feel that way anyhow from the first nine steps. Isn't that something? You know, I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I had completed the first nine steps. And then I realized the results. You see, I started on a journey. Step two, I believed. Step three, I decided. Steps four through nine, I acted. And now the promises are the results. And I don't have to believe anymore, because now I know. I know what the first nine steps will do for me. And it'll do exactly what alcohol used to do, with none of the bad things. Sure.